KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I do store chips. If I chip up branches or things like that, which are great to have on hand.
We're not ready for immortality yet, and we won't be until we learn to respect nature.
It will be a whole new world come 2014 when it comes to Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program.
Are you ready for immortality? We'll find out if a jellyfish can help us with that. Katie Sewell has that. That was Greg Rayburn you heard at the beginning. He's going to talk about things he's storing, our gardening panel. Getting ready to store some things for winter. We're going to start, though, with Medicaid and how Obamacare will affect Washington State's Medicaid program. Nathan Johnson is Assistant Director of Healthcare Policy for the Washington State Healthcare Authority. Nathan Johnson, thanks for talking to us.
Good to join you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
May I start before Medicaid, though, with just a quick question, and I'm sure you know the answer. The fiscal cliff and Medicare, discussions thereof. What are the discussions like about that in your office? Are people concerned? Are people worried?
Well, certainly we're keeping a close watch on things, especially for anything relevant to the Medicaid expansion and any change in FMAP. Conceivably, Congress is discussing elements related to the Medicaid program as part of this discussion, and we just want to be ready to respond to anything that gets laid on the table. But right now, we don't have any specifics to respond to.
What is in the fiscal cliff discussion that affects Medicaid?
Well, nothing until Congress determines what's up for discussion, really, and what's on the table. But certainly, in general, Medicaid, Medicare, entitlement programs more broadly have been discussed previous. But there's no specific proposals yet that we're eyeing related to the Medicaid program. We're kind of waiting to see where the conversation goes.
Well, I wanted to ask you about Medicaid in terms of Obamacare, because once the president was reelected, and once the courts also accepted Obamacare as the plan, there were some leaders in some states saying, well, we're not going to take the Medicaid money from the state, from the federal government, and other states like ours saying, yes, we will. What impact does Obamacare have right now on Medicaid? Before we get to 2014, what impact does it have right now?
Sure. The major impact, of course, comes in 2014 when the expansion occurs. But, of course, the provisions that you're probably familiar with related to maintenance of effort for eligibility purposes for all our programs, those went into place upon the ACA's passage. And so that is something that we have had to contend with as a state in the context of fairly steep recession. And so something that we've had to be very mindful of. But certainly in our planning efforts, 2014 is the big year for Medicaid with the expansion up to 138% of the federal poverty level for all adults in this state.
In part, what you mentioned is because Washington State has been a leader in trying to contain costs in Medicaid yet, and for a while we were being penalized for that, in a sense.
That's right, and one of those elements has been our deepening reliance on managed care and very close partnership with health plans, and we haven't been waiting for 2014 to modernize our Medicaid program, and as recently as this November completed our transition of state-only blind and disabled clients to the managed care program, where we work, again, very closely with our health plan partners to manage and coordinate care for those populations. Today, we have about 75% of our Medicaid population served by health plans in preparation for the major expansion that's looming.
Why don't some states want to take the money that will come with expansion?
It's hard to say. You know, there is a short and long-term outlook that is involved, certainly something that this state is investigating between the legislative and executive branches in terms of the fiscal impact. And, states, their calculus differs. The way they've approached the analysis differs. We have had, I think I'm fairly proud of our efforts to date to model anticipated enrollment as a result of the Medicaid expansion. We know that day one, and even until enrollment stabilizes, not everyone who is eligible will in fact take up coverage. So some of the cost estimates you hear make different assumptions than our state is making about the impact of the Medicaid expansion in particular.
What assumptions is our state making about the cost of Medicaid expansion?
Well, we assume about 500,000 adults will be newly eligible for Medicaid. And over the first 4 years of the program, about half that number we expect to come on to caseload. Of course, for that population, they will be funded with 100% federal dollars. So there is no immediate state fiscal impact. That happens in the out years.
The federal contribution shrinks, correct?
Yes, it shrinks to 90%. It doesn't shrink all that much, but certainly the state has to maintain both a short and long-term outlook. And so there has been an intensive exercise, actually, between the legislative and executive branches to come to consensus on what the inputs and outputs of a budget model should be. And we're very close to having a final budget model for release, and that's surely something to be a part of the governor's budget rollout.
In other states, they're concerned that it's going to hurt the state and they won't be able to afford that expansion, especially in the out years. Where do you see the funding coming from the state to support the expansion by 2017, right? 2020,
sure,
it's at 90%.
Well, there's a significant refinancing opportunity in the Medicaid expansion. There's certain populations today that we have 50% share in who come 2014 will be paid with 100% federal dollars. And so when you look at those populations and look at some of the improvements that we've been making to the Medicaid program in preparation for 2014, as I alluded to some of those earlier, we do believe it will be a sustainable implementation path, both, again, in the immediate budget period that we're facing this next legislative session, but also into the long term. Because it's not as simple as a 10% share that's newly created for the state by 2020, given that there are a significant amount of individuals today covered, for instance, on our waiver programs that are funded with 50% state dollars, and again, that rolls over to 100% federal financing in the year 2014. So significant immediate offsets to any new costs incurred as a result of the Affordable Care Act.
What impact does the expansion of Medicaid have on the basic health plan that Washington State supports?
The basic health plan as we know it today will go away in 2014. Those populations will be served, majority of them, through the Medicaid expansion, as they will be adults under that new FPL threshold of 138%. But in addition, there will be some that will go into the health benefit exchange and be able to receive a subsidized product, much like they do today. I will be slightly different in that context, but that basic health plan is one of those Medicaid waiver programs as of 2011 where we're paying a 50% share today, and the federal government, through both the Medicaid program initially and the exchange, will be picking up 100% of the cost come 2014.
Nathan Johnson is Assistant Director of Healthcare Policy for Washington State Healthcare Authority. We're talking about how the state is preparing for the expansion and the changes coming to Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, or as the president himself embraced it, Obamacare. You talked about the numbers. What is the state spending now on Medicaid?
Oh, that's a great question. And every year, give or take, we spend about $4 billion on the medical side of the program. And then remember that there's a long-term care element of what we do, and that's shared between agencies and state government. So our partners at DSHS manage that program, as well as some of the mental health benefit delivery system managed through our regional support networks in the counties. So the numbers I would give you would be more about the medical expenditures for medical coverage in the context of what healthcare authority is responsible for. But there are other Medicaid costs that when you add them all up together, depending again on how you count it, accrue to about 25% of the current general fund state budget.
Oh, 25%. So what is that in dollars? Is that, what is that, 12? What is that? I don't know.
That's good question. I'm sometimes bad at numbers on the fly. My apologies. I think last time I looked, it's about $8 billion.
Yeah. All right, yeah.
Total funds. That's including the federal share.
And then what do you think it will be, if you can give me this, what do you think it'll be at 2014 or maybe better 2016? I mean, do you have a sense of where the growth will,
sure,
what the growth will be?
Roughly speaking, by the time enrollment stabilizes, we'll be talking about new expenditures, remembering that the vast majority of these are federal expenditures, in the order of $2 billion a year.
So new expenditures from the federal government?
Primarily. 100% federally financed, again, for those first 3 years, with an increasing state share until 2020, when we'll share in 10% of those costs. But remembering that there is significant offsets as a result of the refinancing opportunities that I was alluding to earlier.
Right. So the calculation is that, at least in the short term, in the midterm, it's not going to be a drain on the budget, may even help the state budget.
Yeah, we're still, of course, we're still finalizing numbers and working on all the policy options related to the Medicaid expansion, which programs stay and which programs go away. But in short, I think the governor's fairly confident that the Medicaid expansion will be very sustainable, both in the short and long term.
I guess that takes me back to that question again of why, for example, when I read what the Missouri governor is saying, he has decided that they're going to take part in the health care law. Initially they weren't going to. So some of these states are starting to change their mind as they do the calculation or they realize that they're leaving money on the table no matter what.
Yeah, I think to some degree the analysis has changed and gone deeper into the numbers to investigate state impacts. And, there's some assurances now that the Affordable Care Act is here to stay. And I think states are being responsive to that as well.
Then you also read articles of people saying, that it's going to be a pain because some of those states now have lower reimbursements or receive lower reimbursements or the poor get lower benefits because of the impact that the state economy has had on them. And I think one of the ones I saw was, I think California is one where people are saying, oh, California's going to be worse off because it's so expensive now for them to maintain Medicaid.
And, certainly that issue comes up. One of the things in the Affordable Care Act is a rate increase for primary care physicians, which will be coming on board 2013, where we'll be paying our Medicaid physicians in parity with Medicare, a significant rate increase for many of them. Our Medicaid program did not survive unscathed. There were benefit rollbacks, a chief one among them, adult dental benefits, subject of much consternation and concern. And so we have not escaped unscathed from the recessionary period as it relates to the Medicaid program, but our eligibility has remained intact, and people do have coverage for major medical in this state, which is something to be fairly satisfied about.
I think that's interesting that the Medicaid providers will be getting an increase up to Medicare, even as the Medicare providers are concerned that they will see further cuts in their reimbursement. And that is one of the places where both sides are looking for cost control.
Yep, that's exactly right. And I would say that it's interesting because I think the regulations related to the primary care rate increase had a sense of that and certainly disconnected any future Medicare rate reductions from what would be conceived of for the Medicaid rate increase. And so we're anticipating on January 1, 2013, a rate increase consistent with existing Medicare rates for primary care. And it's something that will be very interesting to monitor, both as it relates to primary care provider participation in the Medicaid program in the short term, and because it's only a two-year project where the federal government is funding, again, 100% of the share of this rate increase over time. It'll be very interesting at the end of that period to investigate what impact it has had on the Medicaid program, and that's something we'll be watching closely here.
Nathan Johnson watches that for the Washington State Healthcare Authority. Let me ask you one last question, just a reaction. I looked at some articles that talked about a University of Virginia study. Here's a quote from Forbes. Studies consistently show that Medicaid patients have the worst health outcomes of any group in America, worse than those with private insurance, and in some cases worse than those with no insurance. They found that surgical patients on Medicaid are 13% more likely to die than those with no insurance at all, 97% more likely to die than those with private insurance. They're making the case in this article against Medicaid for those reasons. What's your interpretation of a study like that? If you know it.
Well, it's hard to fathom the notion that someone is better off with absolutely no access to insurance coverage than some element of access, granted that no insurance program, subsidized or otherwise, is perfect in that regard. But I would point to an earlier Oregon study where they looked at a population that was on a lottery system as to whether they would enroll in Medicaid or not, and that allowed an analysis to be done of those that received coverage and those that didn't with very like circumstances. And I think that Oregon study really refuted some of the premise that's being established in the Virginia study you reference. Their conclusion was that the beneficiaries who were able to be attached to Medicaid coverage, their health outcomes greatly improved. And I would think in our state experience with the expansion where we're covering nearly universally now our children in this state, I think it's nationally renowned, and I think folks feel fairly confident that children in our state are greatly benefiting from those prior expansion activities. And I think they're also figuring that this state will benefit from the Medicaid expansion in the same way, remembering that today these same folks who are either too low income to afford coverage or just have not attached themselves to alternative coverage offerings today, they're accessing this care in some of our most inefficient systems, like emergency rooms, for instance, and a very inefficient way of delivering primary care. And they're going to be attached to primary care providers in this new world. It's a new continuum of coverage, a new way of approaching coverage in this state, in this country, and it's something to be pretty excited about. And I think we'll have to monitor it closely. I think we'll need to do a fair amount of analysis as to whether people are able to access the providers they need, the care they need, to ensure that we're not simply extending coverage that's not meaningful. It has to be a meaningful coverage that folks are attaching themselves to. And I know Healthcare Authority, we're very dedicated to that.
Nathan Johnson, thank you for talking with us.
Well, thanks for your time.
Nathan Johnson is Assistant Director of Healthcare Policy for the Washington State Healthcare Authority, taking a look at how the state is getting ready for the expansion of Medicaid, Washington State's Medicaid program, under the Affordable Care Act, as those rules and ideas are developed for full implementation in 2014. This is Weekday.
Coming up, we'll find out what a jellyfish can teach us about human immortality. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Country Day School, committed to inspiring gifted children K through 8th grade to reach their potential through inquiry, curiosity, and wonder. More information about the school and its programs is at an open house on December 5th, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., and online at seattlecountryday.org.
This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 1021. I'm Andy Hurst. A traffic note to let you know about: starting at 11 this morning, both directions of 520 across Lake Washington will be closed for boat traffic. A delay of 30 minutes is expected. We have clouds and a little bit of sunshine in Seattle, 51 degrees right now in the U District. Forecast calls for clouds and showers all day, the high in the low 50s. Clouds and rain tonight as well, the low in the low 40s.
And now, immortality through a jellyfish. Katie Sewell has been talking to a reporter who's been looking at immortality in jellyfish. Huh? Jellyfish, I knew they glowed green, but now we can maybe learn immortality lessons from them.
Yeah, there is a particular jellyfish that can regenerate itself indefinitely, going from adult, back to child, back to adult, back to child, well, over and over and over again.
Some people's dream, other people's nightmare.
Right. And so scientists think that it might be possible for us to learn a little thing about regenerating our own cells and getting younger by looking at this jellyfish.
You talked to Nathaniel Rich, who is a novelist, Odds Against Tomorrow, but he also wrote about this in the New York Times.
Yes, he did. And I asked him how this immortal jellyfish was discovered.
It was discovered by a man named Christian Sommer, a German graduate student who was studying hydrozoans, small little species that can take the form of a polyp or a medusa, and he found them off the coast of Portofino in Italy near Genoa. And he was diving every morning looking for samples, and he collected dozens and brought them home with him and kept them in petri dishes in the house where he was staying. And every day he monitored them, and he noticed after about a week that one of the species was behaving very strangely, and he realized that it was effectively aging in reverse, going through the life cycle repeatedly. So when it was in a medusa form, instead of spawning and dying, it disintegrated back into a polyp and then birthed new medusas again. He didn't quite understand what was going on, but this was the first discovery that the species was immortal.
Would he have considered it immortal?
He didn't realize that it was immortal because I think he did not understand that it could do this indefinitely. There were other genuine scientists who continued the research, and it was a description of their paper almost 10 years later
that in which the term immortal was first used.
What starts the rejuvenation process for this jellyfish?
When it comes under any kind of stress, a physical stress, meaning if it's attacked, if it's in an environment that doesn't suit it, or if it just becomes old, it will start this process. And what happens is it basically, you know, curls up into a ball, like in the jellyfish equivalent of a fetal position, falls to the ocean floor, clings onto something, and ultimately shoots out little stolons, which are like roots, and those form into a polyp. And a polyp looks something like a small tree branch or twig. And at the end of the twig, where the buds would be, instead of producing a flower, they swell into new medusas, which look like jellyfish, and then start the process anew.
Do we understand how they're able to do this yet?
We don't understand exactly what's going on, which was something that astounded me when I was learning about it, that we still don't know on a genetic level exactly what's happening, although there are some theories. It's believed that the process involves some kind of cellular differentiation, not dissimilar to what happens in the human stem cell. And here they suspect that a cell, after being differentiated, you know, into a, say, a medusa, is effectively reversing its life cycle. So on the cellular level, the life cycle is being reversed. And so that's the speculation, but it hasn't been studied enough by geneticists or molecular biologists to figure out exactly what's going on.
Well, that was one of the surprising things for me reading your article, was imagining this has a human application in the future, that government agencies or even pharmaceutical companies haven't thrown their money at this project. Did you get a sense of why they haven't?
Well, when I asked Kubota about that, he said that he has been approached by businesses before, but when he explains to them that there really needs to be about 10, you know, he says another decade of research before we can really know anything for certain, that companies tend not to want to invest at that point. And in general, there's a bias, I think, this is what's been told to me by scientists I spoke to for the piece, by the major funding agencies who provide research for, you know, human longevity research or cancer research. Generally, the best investment is to invest in testing that's done on mammals, species that most resemble us, and not in simple organisms like hydrozoans. And so it's very difficult to get funding for a project that hopes to study simple cellular organisms and their applications for human medicine. And there's also plainly a lot of skepticism about whether anything that we learn from this species could be adapted for human beings. And it may be that a lot of the research into this subject that will help us is actually already being done in human stem cell research. Funding agencies might be more inclined, they're interested in this field, to be funding human stem cell research rather than the immortal jellyfish.
I'm speaking with Nathaniel Rich, who wrote an article for the New York Times titled, "Can a Jellyfish Unlock the Secret of Immortality?" You mentioned the name Kubota, which was a scientist you followed in Japan. Can you describe him to us?
He's a fascinating, heroic man, and ultimately he's really the subject of the piece. He dedicated his life to studying nature and to studying this species. He's the only man in the world who has consistently been able to culture turptosis in the laboratory. And every day he spends hours feeding them, making sure they're healthy. He has about 100 jellyfish in petri dishes in the refrigerator in his very small, cramped office at Seito Marine Biology Laboratory in the small town of Shirahama, Japan. And he's devoted his life to it, and he's also devoted his life to trying to instill in mankind a love and respect for nature. That's his central mission, and he believes that we're not ready for immortality yet, and we won't be until we learn to respect nature.
Did you get a sense of his motivation, why he would be working with jellyfish to try to discover why they're immortal, while believing that human beings should not have that ability yet?
He wants to be immortal. I mean, he talks about that quite a lot. And, you know, he wants to return to being 20 years old again. He always was telling me that. He showed me pictures of himself at 20. But when I asked him why did he want to be immortal, his answer really moved me. He said, well, so I can continue to study animals forever. He hopes that he'll be able to bring about greater awareness and respect and love for the natural world in his lifetime. So he hopes that we'll be able to evolve, is the word he uses, that we'll evolve spiritually enough so that we can pursue immortality. But I think he's disappointed with the progress that we've made so far, and he feels that things are getting worse and not better.
But he also believes that we're not that far away from unlocking this secret and possibly having immortality at our fingertips. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And he thinks, and he's excited about that. I mean, he thinks that we're a decade or two away from it. I think that would probably put him in the minority among in the scientific community. But he worries, you know, he's excited by the science, but he worries about the application. I mean, he brought up the example of the atomic bomb, where, you know, a scientist could be excited about the advancements we might make in science, but the question is, are we as a society ready to deal with the ramifications? And I think he feels now that even if we were to become immortal, that he would worry about how we might abuse the technology.
Did he change how you see the world after spending so much time with him?
That's a good question. I think so. I spent a week with him in Shirahama. Seeing the world through his eyes for that week, I did feel personally I had a much stronger connection with nature that week than I do the rest of the year when I'm mostly sitting in front of a computer writing or reading books. And here I was out in the world in this beautiful coastal town surrounded by forests and incredible marine landscape. There was a kind of ruminative quality of the time we spent together. It was eye-opening. I don't know if it radically changed my views on the world, because I agree that, like him, you know, he says at one point about modern society, we're in the garbage. And I think that's fairly accurate.
After considering these questions of, and the possibility that we might be immortal 10, 20 years from now, do you agree with him that we're not ready and it shouldn't happen yet, or would you like to see it happen?
Selfishly would like to see it happen, or at least return to a younger age. I mean, that's sort of the promise of this species in an ideal world, is rejuvenating oneself and becoming younger again. You know, the question of whether or not we deserve it or not, I don't really know how to respond to that, but I do think that his fears are real and deserve to be heard.
Nathaniel Rich is an author. His latest novel, Odds Against Tomorrow, will be published in April. And he recently wrote an article for the New York Times titled, Can a Jellyfish Unlock the Secret of Immortality? Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We have cloudy skies and a little bit of sunshine in Seattle, 51 degrees right now in the U District. Forecast calls for a high of 53, clouds and showers the rest of today. Same for tonight and tomorrow, clouds and rain. Tonight's low 43, tomorrow's high reaching 47.
Support for KUOW comes from City People's Mercantile and Garden Store. Both stores offer a selection of practical and whimsical holiday gifts and Washington-grown trees, wreaths, and garland. Locally owned and operated since 1979, with locations in Sandpoint and Madison Valley. More at citypeoples.com.
Now that they've got automobile assembly pretty much down, robot engineers are turning to rows of ripe strawberries.
We watched a bunch of people doing this job, and we thought, if we can't build a robot that does this, we're in the wrong business.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The future for human farm workers is about to change. The story next time on Marketplace from APM.
That story and more coming up tonight at 6:30. 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. It's 10:35.
Support for KUOW comes from Riddell Williams, for over a century providing legal representation and strategic thinking to achieve business objectives. More information on attorneys, experience, and practice areas at Riddell, R-I-D-D-E-L-L, Williams.com.
The Wayne, listen to me. The rain and the cold might have you thinking that we should just relax with our gardens for a few months. Well, that's what I'm thinking. So that's why today, except for a surprise later, Marty Wingate, Greg Rayburn, and Willie Galloway will hang up their slickers for a couple of weeks, get ready for the holidays, and then come back, what'd we say, at the end of January, I believe.
We'll be putting our slickers on is what we'll be doing.
Yes, you will.
Get back out in the garden and get all that work done we talk about.
Marty Wingate writes about gardens and traveling. You can find her works at martywingate.com. She's written Landscaping for Privacy, a book about that. And she's working on her mysteries.
I am.
Garden plot, where are we at?
The garden plot.
I like to track your progress.
It
makes me feel hopeful.
We are making progress in the publishing world. I'll just say that.
Good. I like to hear that. Willie Galloway is host of the gardening and cooking website, digginfood.com. Her new book is Grow, Cook, Eat. It's about those things. Hello, Willie.
Hello.
How's the world of Portland, Oregon?
It's rainy and windy down here.
Excellent. It should be. And Greg Rayburn is Vashon Basin Steward, works for King County on habitat restoration, also co-hosts King County TV's Yard Talk. You guys made any new, I don't mean to point it out, but have you made any new episodes lately?
We hope to soon.
Good.
We're in the script writing phase.
Oh, excellent. Any particularly interesting scripts you're writing?
Or any good jokes you're going to include?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Nothing like being put on the spot to tell a joke.
Yeah. We will send you jokes. During the next few weeks, if people have jokes for Greg, just post them on the Facebook page.
Garden-related jokes.
Garden-related jokes.
Of course.
Weekday on KUOW. All right, so you may have some questions about this, what to do this time of year. And I have some questions about some mistakes I made. And then, so you can call 206-543-5869 or 1-800-289-5869. But what are you doing now in that lovely garden? Are you just enjoying the blossoms of the winter?
I'm enjoying berries and the variegated foliage, which of course shows up really well on dark days. I got two pots of a sedge called Evergold that is really, really bright. And I'm going to put one each. They're going to flank the top of the concrete steps at our house as soon as I find the perfect pots, which of course have to match. Not big, tall pots. I want sort of short, round.
How big is the sedge?
Well, they're in 6-inch pots right now. It's not quite that gallon.
How big could it get?
Between. Oh, it doesn't get very big.
Small.
It just looks fabulous.
A nice winter view.
It's bright. It's like a light in the garden without using any electricity.
Well, that's very nice. Yeah. What are you doing in yours, Willie, to bring in the season?
Well, I am collecting stuff from my yard for holiday decorations. So we have, unfortunately, it's actually in my neighbor's yard, but a holly tree that hangs into our yard. So I've been clipping off holly for the wreath on my front porch. And we had a big tree branch come down last winter. And so but it has really cool moss on it. So I'm trimming that off and bringing that inside for a centerpiece for my Christmas decorations. And also we have some fir trees. And so I've also clipped off some little branches of that to kind of put around the base of some candles and stuff. So I'm trying to decorate with free things from my garden.
It's very Martha Stewart-y of you.
Well, I'm not the craftiest person, but I'm trying.
What are you doing?
Well, I finally went out to plant my garlic, and then the woods called me, because the nettles have died back enough. So now is a great time to go out and actually find invasive plants. So I started wandering through the woods, and I found some Scott's broom, and then found some ivy seedlings, which I thought I'd eradicated all my ivy. But, of course, the birds brought in some new little ivy seedlings.
And everything's small enough to pull up.
Yeah, and the soil's moist, and I was able to pull up a couple of holly trees. They weren't suitable for decorations, but they now are.
Well, I will say that that reminds me that the Arboretum Foundation has its greens and gifts sale this weekend, Friday and Saturday. They're going to be, they don't sell any, they cut,
They sell cut greens, but they don't sell any English holly, any invasive holly. They do have some holly that you can buy that is not invasive. Makes great decorations. And also, besides all the gifts in the wonderful gift shop, Deborah Prinzing is going to be doing a floral arrangement or an winter arrangement workshop, not just flowers, over the weekend. So arboretumfoundation.org, you can get all the information.
All right, great. That sounds fun. You can call us with questions, 206-543-5869 or 1-800-289-5869. Or you can email us weekday at kuow.org. Anne wrote, I would appreciate some tips for straightening an over 5 foot tree peony and a flowering plum with a trunk diameter of about 3 inches.
Straightening?
Straightening. Both are several years old and not properly staked and were not properly staked when planted. Now they're growing to the side, not straight.
Well, I would think if they've been in the ground that long, they're growing to the side because they're growing toward the light. That happens a lot. And usually plants will, you know, that's what determines which way they're leaning. It certainly does in my garden. I just noticed some things that were leaning far, far away to try to get the light. A tree peony is a woody plant. That's a shrub. And so you could try pruning off a branch that is leaning too far and see if it promotes some more upright growth.
But why wouldn't you do that?
I don't know. Tree peonies scare me.
Oh, just in general.
I mean, they're gorgeous. They're fabulous. But and they have some wonderful examples in the Arboretum. But I would maybe just one branch and see if that does anything for the next year's growth. But I have a feeling it's more than just the way they were planted.
I see. All right. All right. How about this one? Here's a tough one for you from Sandra. Well, maybe. After testing many kinds of fruit juice, Consumer Reports found that some samples of apple and grape juice were high in arsenic and lead, recommended that children do not drink very much juice. They did not test soil samples, but assumed the contamination was from pesticides used years ago. Have you ever heard of soil test results from our state that showed high levels of contaminants? Home fruit growers need to know. Sandy and Brian says. Have you ever heard of anything like that, Willie?
Well, in some parts of Vashon Island, there are, you know, higher levels of arsenic from the Sarco smelter that was in Tacoma that was shut down many years ago. So, you know, there can be pockets of places in King County that might have higher levels of heavy metals than others.
Are those taken up into the plant, though? Are those taken up into the fruit?
I don't know about that. I know that recently rice was found, a lot of rice that's grown in the United States was found to have high levels of arsenic due to past pesticide use on the same land that the rice is grown. So it probably depends on the plant if the heavy metals are taken up into it or not. And I don't know the answer to that. But if you are concerned about what might be in your soil, lead, arsenic, you can have that tested. And if you go on the Master Gardener's website, they have a list of labs locally that will test, and you can call the labs to see if they do heavy metal testing before you send in a soil sample. Washington State University doesn't do soil testing for the general public anymore, but you can have your soil tested locally.
There, if you, Department of Ecology has a whole Asarco plume project, and so you can go on there and find maps of the plume, because it's in addition to, of course, Vashon and Maury Islands, there's the area around Tacoma. And also the plume went north, so Federal Way, Burien, I mean, that whole area, you can have hot pockets. So there's a lot of information there. And a lot of that can be, a lot of your concerns can be alleviated by making sure to really wash your produce and wash your hands and, you know, be clean and avoid ingesting the dirt, which is where the highest risk is. And different plants will take up different amount of the metal. So some plants, like there was a Chinese brake fern that was brought over for the purpose of trying to clean soils that had heavy metals, because it was its ability to take up, it readily took up, I think it was, I can't remember if it was the arsenic or the lead. I think it was the arsenic. And with the idea that it would pull it out of the soil and then you'd be able to harvest it. Turned out not to be very hardy to this zone, though. But
You touched on a lot of this, but Cornell and other places, best practices for healthy gardens, incorporate or top dress the garden with clean materials, adjust the pH to near neutral, mulch walkways and other areas to reduce dust and soil splashback. Don't grow edible produce directly adjacent to buildings where lead levels are the highest, likely the highest. Build raised beds with clean soil to grow food in more contaminated areas with a layer of landscape fabric to help prevent some mixing, and more like that, a whole list of issues like that take up. Our number, 206-543-5869, if you have some questions for Greg, for Marty, for Willie, or 1-800-289-5869, or you can email us. Karen writes, I have two questions regarding the Madrona tree in our front yard, or in our yard. We have an adult tree that's been in our yard on the property line for about 30 or 40 years. We've been on a home 20-plus years. It was full size at that time. Questions. There are branches that are obviously dead, black. Can I trim these at any time? Madrona trimming?
If it's a dead branch and it's entirely dead, yeah, you can trim those off. You want to be careful not to trim into the branch collar on the limb.
Oh, yeah.
You can take off the dead wood. They do a lot of times... Madronas are very susceptible to a few different diseases, and that dieback could be part of a larger tree problem.
We're getting Madrona starts that sprout at the base of our large fir tree on the planting strip. We've tried to transplant them, but they did not take. Any suggestions as to what to do with the starts? We typically do not see them until they are 2 to 3 feet tall. So is that too late to transplant a Madrona?
Yeah, I try and get them when they're below a foot. And also when you transplant them, try and transplant them so that they're oriented the same way, north, south, east, west, as they were from the location they came from.
Really?
That seems to help their survival to have them oriented that way.
So Madrones not only know which way is up.
Yeah.
They know which way is north.
Which way is north, south, east, west?
And don't pamper them too much after you do it. They often will, people will water them to death or give them too nice a soil. Remember, these are trees that thrive, have grown in some of the toughest conditions that we can dish at them.
Yeah.
Have we figured out, is there enough research now to know what was happening or has been happening to Madrones in, I guess, Puget Sound? Or is it around the region that Madrones were? For a while, there was concerns that they were massively dying.
Yeah, well, everything I've seen points to a number of different indicators, ranging from they don't handle disturbance well. So we tend in urban areas or suburban areas, we tend to have lots of disturbance, roads, air quality, watering, fertilizers, all those things that can really stress the Madrones. And you also combine that with, in some areas, like you see this a lot over on Vashon, where you have these Madrone forests that are now being out-competed by, and they're being shaded out by Doug firs and things like that. So, I mean, it's kind of the natural tree succession.
Except they don't see the same kind of tree fires or falls that maybe the natural forest would see, right?
Yeah, so you have areas where there's steep bluffs where the firs aren't able to get a purchase, and those are doing okay. But then you get up on the flat areas where the Madrones were, where the firs can grow fine, and the firs are out-competing.
When people came to cut trees down in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, did they leave Madrones and cut the firs, or did they, because they weren't clear cutting to the extent that they do later, right?
Oh, the pictures I saw of
historic cut
on, there was hardly anything standing. They pretty much shaved it bald.
Shaved it bald. All right. A couple of questions from you before we're done. Becca's on Finney Ridge. Hi, Becca.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Sure. Hey, I have a question because I have several pots on my deck that have Japanese maples in them, and they're not very big, but they've been in the pots for about 3 years, and I'm wondering about the winter and whether I should just be leaving them out on the deck or whether I should be, what I should be doing about them in the winter.
Have they been out on the deck the last two winters?
Well, we've been moving them around, and they've been... The last winter, they were under the eaves. We have really deep eaves. And this year, they're out on the edges, and they're gotten heavier.
Ah, yes.
And my husband is worried that, you know, he's like, well, they need to stay wet. They need to stay out where they get water. But I'm worried about freezing and whether they're okay in the pots.
Well, how big are the pots?
Bigger than 5 gallons. They're bigger than a 5 gallon bucket, but they're not a whole lot bigger than that.
Yeah. I think that, of course, I cannot predict the weather, but if we don't get any of those really bad freezes, they should be fine. It might be the case that you want to lift them up off the deck. If they're sitting on solid surface, they could get too wet. And you don't want them, you want them to be able to drain. You want the pots to be able to drain. And if that's the case, you could always get those little wheeled things that you could set the pots on. And then if it gets really cold, you can bring them up against the house. They'd be more protected. Then you could wheel them back out again. I know it's a lot of work, but.
Got it, right. Right. And then my other question about those trees is, how do we know when they need to be in a bigger pot?
What's the cue for moving trees? You must have to think about that, Greg.
Yeah, you can usually, oftentimes, I just like grab a hold of the tree in the pot and check down around and see if it's starting to get root bound. Or lots of times the roots, you'll actually see them come up on the soil and the surface, but that's a little bit later than what you want to do something prior to the roots surfacing like that. But
if they've been in this same size pot for 3 years, you might want to pot them up next spring.
All right, good. Becca, thanks. And Isabel in Snoqualmie, what are you thinking about?
Well, every year I plant Brussels sprouts for a Brussels sprout family, and apparently I'm routinely putting them out a little too late. I'm wondering when the best time is to put them out so I can actually harvest them and enjoy them.
When's the best time to plant Brussels sprouts, Willie Galloway?
Usually, if you want to harvest them, you're probably going to need to get them in mid-July.
So mid-July. And then when does she harvest them?
Well, you can really harvest Brussels sprouts at any time, depending on the size that you like. When they're the size of like a big cat's eye marble is kind of the size I like. But, you just have to, one thing you might want to consider with Brussels sprouts is when you plant them out in July, putting a really light row cover over them because they're super susceptible to aphids. And so at Thanksgiving, we tried to have Brussels sprouts and they were so full of aphids. We had to compost them instead of have Brussels sprouts at Thanksgiving. So that's one kind of tricky thing with Brussels sprouts, especially in the Northwest, is they can just really fill up with aphids. So putting a row cover over them when you plant them can really help prevent that.
All right. All right. Any last words before you guys go into hibernation?
Buy more plants.
buy more plants. All right. These guys will be back. Actually, do you have a last word?
Oh, I was just going to say, just because the weather turns, it's not time to quit gardening. There's still lots of things to do in the garden.
You're planting.
Yeah, planting, weeding. Lots of good stuff going
on. Oh, yeah, there's always weeding.
All right. These guys will be back next week to talk a little bit about gifts for the garden. Marty Wingate, Greg Rayburn, Willie Galloway, thank you all very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This is Weekday. So we are also taking some time to see what you are doing to help each other, help other people, helping each other during this holiday season. Treehouse is committed to improving the lives of kids living in foster care, and during the holiday season, they raise funds, gather donations to give each foster child living in Washington State a Christmas gift. Janice Avery is CEO of Treehouse. Hello, Janice.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us.
Delighted to be here.
What are you, you're fundraising for some gifts, for money, for clothes? Where are you doing this?
We do all of those things. So folks can come visit the Holiday Carousel downtown at Westlake, pay for a ride on the carousel, and that benefits Treehouse, the Downtown Seattle Association. At the end of that ride, you can pick up a bag and do some special shopping, buy things that your kids love to bring back to the carousel for kids in foster care. Another idea is folks can invite their friends at a church or a book group or your colleagues at work to pick an age group or a particular thing that the kids you know like and collect those tangible items for kids in foster care for Christmas. And we'll be delighted to distribute them through the end of the month.
Now, do you also have an event coming up on Thursday?
On the 12th.
On the 12th.
It's Holiday Magic, which is a 23-year-long relationship with the Department of Social and Health Services, which runs the foster care system. And we raise money for gifts for 5,000 kids in foster care all around the state. Kids select something out of a special catalog, and we then deliver that gift directly to their door.
You are serving how many kids in Washington State? 5,500 young people and families?
Exactly.
Where are you contacting them? These are all kids in foster care and then the foster care families.
Yes, and so their social workers refer them to Treehouse for services ranging from holiday gifts all the way up to educational supports. But this time of year, we are particularly focused on the holidays because kids in foster care are living with families that are not their own. Their lives are disrupted. They're feeling often somewhat distressed, not quite belonging. And so these gestures of gifts from a community that cares about them helps them feel more connected and more supported.
Treehouse was founded by DSHS caseworkers in the 1980s, huh?
That's right. Yeah, social workers who felt like some of their very simple, natural childhood needs were not being met. And it's grown into a fully supported community agency that cares about kids in foster care.
When you talk to people about foster care, what's the biggest need that you try to convey to people?
So kids in foster care don't get some of the opportunities that yours and my kids would naturally just by being part of our family. The need to have a consistent, loving presence in their lives, the need to explore through other relationships, the needs for constancy. So when families and schools and communities are changing, kids don't always build those natural relationships, those natural mentoring relationships with a neighbor or a coach or a teacher because there's so much change. And so by paying for extracurricular activities and summer camps, by providing additional educational support, and of course these holiday gifts, Treehouse helps to create those connections that help kids kind of rebuild their sense of self, recognize themselves as strong and resilient people who can do the things they want to do.
Well, great. All right, so people can find out more about Treehouse. We have links, and they can go downtown and take part in that drive and help foster kids have a good holiday season. Janice Avery, thanks a lot.
Delightful to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Janice Avery is CEO of Treehouse. More information at our website and our Facebook page. If there are groups you're working with, post what you're doing and what those groups are doing there as well, and we'll continue to talk to these groups throughout the holiday season.
And now, the sound of the day.
Willie Weir and Cat Mariner were near a pagoda, near Bagan, in a large pagoda in Bagan, in Myanmar. They were bicycling around the country, around Southeast Asia as well. And while Willie was there, the full moon festival was approaching, and the late afternoons were calm and peaceful, and the setting had brought flocks and flocks of chattering sparrows to the sunset, looking for bits of food, because there's those offerings that visitors have left at the pagoda. And while they're chattering, nuns are rushing about, placing lit candles all around the enormous base of the pagoda. What interesting sounds are you hearing in Myanmar or in your backyard? Record 30 seconds, send it to us with Sound of the Day in the subject line. Weekday at KUOW.org. Have a good day. We'll talk tomorrow.
Good morning. It's 10:59. We'll get an update from NPR News coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from La Tienda Folk Art Gallery, offering a wide selection of handmade jewelry, art glass, and one-of-a-kind gift items from around the world and local craftspersons. La Tienda, serving Seattle for 50 years, located in Ballard at 2050 Northwest Market Street.
There have been so many pivotal moments in the long, tragic narrative called the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. December marks 20 years since the secret meetings that led to the 1993 Oslo Accords. So much promise, what is there to show for it? We'll explore next time on The Takeaway from Public Radio International.
And that comes your way this afternoon at 1 o'clock. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.